Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Yo, welcome to the podcast. Matt.
whoa. Hey, yo, what up?
Yeah.
Okay, right. we probably lost some listeners there. Sorry, we are in part two of a replay of Dr. Nathan Cartagena's educational and riveting discussion on critical race theory. If you haven't listened to the first episode, go ahead and do that now. Ben, why are we replaying this?
We cover this in the intro to the first episode, but we feel that These talks sound like talks. It's like an extended one recording session, I think, with Dr. Cartagena. But I think what he lays out in terms of what critical race theory is and the work that it does and what it helps us see is more relevant than ever.
Yeah.
Here in 2023, 2 years later.
I thought it was a softball. I was thinking you would say something like, we're doing this because we're traveling a lot and we don't have time to record other podcasts.
Well, that too. Oh, yes. Okay. So anyway, probably by the time you're listening to this, I will be on vacation. But that's the reason that we're doing, it's a dual reason. We're replaying some of our most downloaded podcasts and also taking a little break for vacation. So if you haven't heard these, listen in, but they definitely sort of go, more than any of our other series, they definitely go in order. And so it actually would be helpful. You could probably get a lot out of just listening to this one, but we'd encourage you to go back and listen to part one before you listen to this one and get the whole deal.
All right, let's shut up so we can giddy up.
Let's do it.
So I want to make the best use of our time, Nathan, because the days are evil. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and so, they are.
Yes. There's people out there strategizing.
So yeah, yes. There's people out there
cynically.
critical race theory as a sociological tool threatens something. Yep. It's a threat, which is why it's been demonized. In order to name what it threatens. We had conversations offline about how we need to back up and talk about how the thing that it threatens was constructed. So would you, maybe we'll begin on this episode and maybe have to wrap up in the next episode, but will you take us back a few hundred years and help us understand what does CRT threaten and how was that created?
Yeah. So again, remember that the legal movement is aimed at understanding how law has fostered and perpetuated racism and white supremacy. And I want to stress this. Critical race theorists are going to say you can't conceptually decouple racism from white supremacy because white supremacy serves as the foundation for racism. Now, for some people, this is going to sound shocking. So So I want to say this. One of the things you've heard now in our podcast conversation is the problem of organized forgetting. So a lot of people we don't know much about the broader history. We don't know much about U.S. history. We don't know much about, say, the global church's history, et cetera. And this reminds me of a very important quotation from a Christian brother, George Erasmus, who's of the Dene people of Canada. He says the following: where common memory is lacking, where people do not share the same past, there can be no real community. Where community is to be formed, common memory must be created. So what I'd like to do is try to help us to have a common memory before we launch into more fine-grained reflections on CRT. So what I'm going to be doing now is taking us all the way back to 1444. We're going to be on one of my family's peninsulas, Iberian Peninsula. So from my dad's side of the family, we have family members from Spain and from Portugal. So we're going to go to Portugal. 1444. Here's why this is going to be so important. What I'm going to read is an excerpt from the very first ever racialized slave auction. So the Portuguese are looking for ways to expand their empire while in part crusading against Muslims, especially in Northwest Africa. And this part about the crusade is very important because a lot of the crusading rhetoric that's weaponized against Muslims is going to come into play, you'll see, in what ends up being the construction of the Americas. But here's something I want to make sure that we see. So when we're talking about white supremacy, we're going to talk about the following. It's the idea that whatever gets deemed as white, and that changes throughout history, is seen as superior, and then everything else is going to be seen as non-white, and it will fall on a graded scale of being less than white, but, well, it might be more superior than this. And typically, what is deemed black, when this changes too, is at the bottom. So let me read you an excerpt that shows you the racial scale that's connected to white supremacy. Again, this is going all the way back to 1444. I'm reading from a Portuguese chronicler. His name is Azuara. And he's going to give us a recording of the very first racialized slave auction. So Portuguese soldiers have gone down into North and West Africa. They have captured people. They're saying that they've captured them in just warfare. So now they're supposed to be their slaves, and there's soon going to be a selling of these slaves. And so it reads as follows. On the next day, which was the 8th of the month of August, very early in the morning, by reason of the heat, the seamen began to make ready their boats and to take out those captives. Remember, they're seeing them as slaves from a just war, and carry them on shore as they were commanded. And these, placed all together in that field, were a marvelous sight. So all the slaves. For amongst them were some white enough, fair to look upon, and well-proportioned. So whiteness is being connected to what is beautiful, what is attractive. Then others were less white, like mulattoes, which is often a category for somebody that's, you might think, half white, half black. No real explanation about the mulattoes. Well, less white. Do you see that? So white's still on top, and it's less white. And then others, again, were as black as Ethiopes. And notice what follows. And so, this means it's a logical connection, ugly, both in features and in body, as almost to appear to those who saw them, the images of a lower hemisphere. What Azuara is actually talking about, given the cosmology he's operating, is it's like these people have hellish flesh. And Ethiopes, it's a Greek word for burnt skin. So the idea is like, yeah, these people, it's like they have hellish flesh. So white is attractive, beautiful, it's fair to look upon. Mulattoes are less white, and then there's the blacks. Ooh, that's nasty. Now, this idea about the racial scale is going to be so important because from Iberia, Spain, and Portugal, you're going to get the spreading of global missions, and you're going to get what ends up being the colonizing of what we might now think about as the West. And all of that's going to be endorsed by multiple popes, from Pope Nicholas V, in 1452, for example, going all the way to Pope Alexander in 1493. Now, I want to say a little bit more to help people understand how radical European colonialism is. So remember, part of what's going on is crusading. And in fact, if I can read you this quotation, this is from Pope Nicholas in 1452. He says, as he's thinking about what the Portuguese are doing, he's going to grant the Portuguese king, Afonso V, the right to invade, I'm now quoting directly, invade, seek out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Muslims and pagans whatsoever. This point about pagans, very important because of how it's going to get linked into the indigenous. And other enemies of Christ, wheresoever placed, wherever they are. And kingdoms, dukedoms, principalities, dominions, possessions, and all movable and immovable goods, whatsoever held and possessed by them, and to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. You see how the slave trade is starting to get cooked up? Mm. The racialized slave trade? And this is, again, connected to the church. This is the Pope. And you don't have the Reformation right now. You don't have the Protestant Reformation. This is what everybody's is hearing this. Now, of course, you do have Orthodox versus what we now think about as Roman Catholic divisal, of course. That's, you know, that's going back way before that. But notice, those are going to see themselves as part of the Western Church. This is what the Vicar of Christ is telling you. So reduce their persons to perpetual slavery and to apply and to appropriate to himself and his successors the kingdoms, dukedoms, countries, principalities, dominions, possessions, and goods, and to convert them to his and their use and profit. Use and profit. Now, remember I said the idea about the Pope as the Vicar of Christ? Part of what we have to see is not only are people going to say, well, Jesus, he tabs, the thought is, Peter as his successor. But he says, oh, you have the kingdoms. You have the keys to the kingdom. And whatever you bind and loose on heaven, it's going to be bound and loose. On earth, it's going to be bound and loose in heaven. So notice, and another papal bull that's going to be important for the doctrine of discovering, we're going to get there in just a minute. This was coming from 1455. We read the following. The Roman pontiff, successor of the key bearer of the heavenly kingdom and vicar of Christ. And what this is going to go on to do, this is Romanus Pontifex, is going to say, okay, yep, what we should be doing is following what we're seeing coming out of Iberia. That's what Christian kings should be doing. Calls them Catholic kings. Now, there's going to be, therefore, a papal support for imperial expansion under the name of Christ. And here's what we have to see. This is happening in what's known politically as a feudal system. So the idea is God is complete sovereign, has all the power, all the authority. And you think about the end of Matthew, Jesus says, all authority in heaven has been given to me. Well, then the thought is, well, all authority has been given to Jesus, but then Jesus, vicar, is the Pope. So all that sort of authority goes to the Pope. Now, not everybody endorses this view. Some are like, no, we don't think the Pope has all that power. But many people do. So the Pope then gets to empower those that are going to be kings and queens. The Pope gives them power. And then those people can then empower folks that are going to be the landed gentry, you might say. And then they give rights and privileges to whomever they're going to give. So there's this direct chain in people's minds about how power and authority and distribution is going to work. From God through the Pope to the nation's monarchs or the Catholic kings and queens, and then to other folks that are going to be a kind of aristocracy, and then you're going to get forms of servitude that will come. But here's what's also happening. These people have no idea that Mi Familia, the Taínos, exist. Because at this time, if you look for a map of the world, you're going to find what's called the TNO map. So it's the letter T, the letter N, the letter O map. And you get three continents. You get Europe, Asia, Africa. Mm. That's it. So in 1492, when Columbus is trying to make his way to the India, he's trying to get to India. He wants to get all the spices and all the silk trade stuff that's going on. When he encounters, notice I say encounters, not discovers. When he encounters Mi Gente, it's like, well, I guess I found the Indians, but this isn't what I was expecting. So notice, now the Christian, again, this is so important because some people want to use no ideas about Christian worldview as if it's just this one monolithic thing. Most of us aren't thinking, if you're Protestants, for example, the power goes from God to the Pope to the kings and queens, et cetera, et cetera. We're also not thinking, well, Christians thought that there were just these three continents? Yeah, for a long, 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 long time. Mm-hmm. Now you encounter all these other lands and peoples. And one of the questions people ask, like, are these folks related to Adam? Where did they come from? Because this is shocking. But remember that language about kings grabbing and subduing and putting people in perpetual slavery? Well, here's something that's very important to see. Once the TNO map gets busted and people are like, whoa, now we have all these other continents, it's important to see that the racial project is really now going to get thoroughly underway. So this is what scholars Michael Omi and Howard Winant will call the racial formation process. The racial formation process. So that idea about whiteness and who's superior, that is something that every single European empire buys into and spreads. Now, they don't all have the same ideas about what counts as white. So for the Spanish, to be white is to be Catholic. it's to be Spanish speaking, it's to be coming from Spain, et cetera, right? For the British later, it's going to be, well, no, it's to be British, it's to be light skinned as they're seeing it, but it's to speak English. It's actually not to be Catholic, it's to be Protestant, et cetera, although these different conceptions of whiteness are going to work out. But they're all thinking, you know, white is supreme, and this is so important to see too, they're sending missionaries to places that they deem to be more white or not. So for example, some of the Jesuits, they go to Japan rather than to India because they think that the Japanese are part of the white race and the yes. Indians and the country of India are part of the black race. So I tell my students, the reason you have a book like Endo Silence is because of white supremacy being spread through missions works. But those same people that see themselves as white, now they're going to encounter the indigenous peoples of what we would call today the Americas, but Turtle Island and the various lands like Boricua. So I want to make sure I read this one line from Omi and Winant. They stress that European conquests of indigenous peoples, quote, was the first and given the dramatic nature, perhaps the greatest racial formation project. The first and perhaps the greatest racial formation project. So you're going to have Spaniards, the Portuguese, seeing themselves as white, coming into what we're now thinking about as the Western Hemisphere, and they're going to try to expand their empires, and they do it in what scholars, the Iberian scholar C.R. Boxer calls as an effort to establish a pigmentocracy, a government that's supposed to be for and by those deemed white. So pigmentocracy, a government that's supposed to be for and by those deemed white. Again, the scholar C.R. Boxer. This gets connected to Pope Alexander the VI's important paper bull that's known as the division of the, it's called Undiscovered World between Spain and Portugal. So this, you get this stuff, Spain, Portugal, you get this stuff. So you get multiple papal bulls that come together to form what's known as the Doctrine of Discovery. It goes like this. The Pope is saying, as the vicar of Christ, with the power of Christ, I'm telling you all that if you land somewhere in these undiscovered worlds, which is, again, it's just, this is how Eurocentric it is, because these people have been living there for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. But you find something where there have been no Christians before, then you can plant your flag, claim it for your kingdom, and then, of course, ultimately for the kingdom of God that I'm connected to. So this is what people are doing. And so listen to this. This is one of the things that a Spanish colonizer, Martin Fernandez de Enciso, is going to say. He says, quote, as he's engaging the indigenous, the Spanish king might very justly send me to require those idolatrous Indians to hand over their land to him, for it was given him by the Pope. Remember I was talking about how land and a power and authority is going to work? If the Indians would not do this, he might justly wage war against them, kill and enslave those captured in war, precisely as Joshua treated the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. So here's something else you got to see. Whether it's going to be British, the Spanish, the Portuguese, they're going to start seeing themselves not only as racialized whites, but they're like, oh, Christianity is bound up with whiteness. Christianity is bound up with being European. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see ourselves as those that are conquering like Joshua conquered the Canaanites. So time and again, indigenous peoples are presented as these heinous, idolatrous Canaanites that if they don't immediately repent when you read something like the Recueramento, mm-hmm. which you got people reading while they're actually like running across the hill trying to kill somebody with a sword. Yeah. It's like, well, if you quickly repent, da-da-da-da-da. Right? That's how this is. It's egregious stuff. Mm-hmm. But they're thinking, okay, nope, now we can capture you. This has all been given to us by the Pope through the monarch, and we're doing God's good work like Joshua was doing God's good work. And you mm-hmm. find the same kind of rhetoric from the Puritans. When they're talking about being a city on the hill, going into the wilderness, right? So I want to highlight this. People have to see there are so many commonalities between these European empires. Even though they're going to be at war with themselves, even though they're all fighting to get to get land and to get resources, and they want to have sugar plantations and tobacco plantations and all this sort of stuff, there are a lot of theological ideas in common. So notice, one of the things I've already shown then is white supremacy is a distinctively Christian construction and heresy. So too, the doctrine of discovery that gets tied into the ability now to just take, if you are a Christian and they're seen as not, take their lands. Mm. That's also a distinctively Christian construction that's heresy. So part of the big problem that I'm seeing in seminaries is we don't talk about these portions of church history.
No.
Like there's going to be this jumping from Augustine into the Reformation, a certain understanding about Martin Luther. Maybe we talk about how, well, it seems he actually is pretty anti-Semitic at different points, but well, okay, we'll keep moving on. But they don't say, for example, that Calvin, when he's in Geneva, is connected to groups that are sending missionaries down to Brazil, to indigenous peoples. And those missionaries are connected to the broader imperial project in Brazil to establish sugar plantations. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to highlight this. Notice one of the things that's going on. As these empires of Europe are expanding, they want land, and they want the resources on the land.
Yep.
So you can't understand racialization until you see that this is so much about the spreading of peoples to grab resources.
Yeah.
And I say this because in 1512, you get the very first ever legal racial category. It's going to separate those that are deemed as white, the Spanish, from another group. And in the United States, we're not expecting this because we so often operate in a black-white binary. The laws of Burgos in 1512 establish the legal category Indian. The legal category Indian. And there, so you get certain rights and privileges that go to the Spanish that are seen as white and Christian. And then it's a subordination of this other race, the Indians. And in the beginning, it's the indigenous that are getting enslaved. It's the Indios that are going to get enslaved. But as their populations are being so oppressed, so exploited, they're dying out from disease. Of course, indigenous people are still here. It's not like they just fully died out. This is another myth we got to get rid of. But one of the things that you find is people like Bartolome de las Casas going, whoa, hold on. This is heinous treatment. Let's take these African slaves that we acquired through that just warfare against the Muslims, and let's have them work here. This is going to bring over the Africans. So you get African slaves coming initially to places like Hispaniola in the early 16th century connected to Spain. But of course, the Dutch is going to be connected to this. The French are going to be connected to this. The British are eventually going to be connected to this. I want to say this too. And now I'm going to be pivoting more towards Britain, and then we're going to go into the U.S. So one of the things that's gone on is initially Britain's got a relationship with the Pope so that they can go ahead and try to do some excursions in the quote-unquote New World, which is not new. The initial efforts fail, but one of the things you're getting with the Reformation is a breaking and a changing of the power structure that I said, especially when you're getting with the English. Because they're like, no. Henry, King Henry, is the head of the Church of England, not the Pope. Now, notice how important of a shift this was, because I was saying it goes from the Pope to the kings. Mm-hmm. You say, no. Henry is in fact the head of the church. And then whoever is going to be in power that's Henry's children is going to be the head. Well, this means what you're going to get is this idea that the monarch is the head of the church and also now the one by the monarch's own power, king or the queen, that's going to be establishing groups that will have the power and authority of the monarch to go and do what are known as crown charters. So you can go into the New World and you can claim this place as a Christian using the doctrine of discovery, because I, the head of the church and the one with all the civic power, have affirmed that this is what you can go on to do. And so, for example, what are now states, but were initially colonies like Virginia and Georgia, they had land charters to supposedly claim all the land that they got. Like, once you get there, they're no Christians. You just keep on going west, and you can claim all of it, and it's all yours.
Yeah.
Of course, that also means it's all Britain's. Now, I need to say one more thing before we get into some of the nuts and bolts of that. During the Elizabethan period, you still don't really have the English doing a lot of colonizing with any success in what we now call North America. But they do practice conquest, and they do it against the Irish. And a lot of that rhetoric about the pagans and the barbarians that you saw from the Crusade period gets used against not now only the indigenous, but the Irish. It's going to be important because the Irish, when they're first coming to the United States, are actually going to typically be racialized as black because of the antagonism between England and Ireland. But this is important to see because they're going to hone their conquering abilities against the Irish, and then they bring those with them to what we now call the United States. Now, you get a bunch of wars. And at the end of what's known as the French and Indian War, which shows you that we're now operating out of this distinctly British idea, you get King George III saying, okay, we got to have a proclamation. So it's the proclamation of 1763. King George says, okay, we need to make it so that nobody going nobody under my power as the King of England is going to go west of this line in the Appalachians. Nope. All that is just going to be indigenous lands. Now, wait a second. Remember what I told you about the crown charters? It was like, once you land, you can just keep on going. All that could be yours. And here's something that's key. Founders of the U.S., many of them were land surveyors. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. In fact, Thomas Jefferson's dad, land surveyor. And they got lots of money into having places like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. So there were all sorts of dirty deals going on. And they're like, whoa. No, the king can't tell us that we can't own that land. So one of the primary, not exclusive, one of the primary reasons for the U.S. Revolution is you have these people who have slaves, who want to expand and gain a tremendous amount of wealth. And they're looking at all this fertile land. They're going, you can't stop us. We have charters.
Yes.
And their ideas about white superiority, right? And their ideas about Christian theology that are linked in this. They're like, you don't get to stop us. We're going.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Now, I want you to see, at this point, there are new developments too. Because in 1642, we get the very first ever writing about a state in the way that we would think about states. This comes from Thomas Hobbes' book, The Keyway, so on citizens. And Thomas Hobbes is the first person to ever talk about a state in the way that we might now today think about nation states. And notice it's an effort to further, as it were, remove certain distinctively religious authorities from the broader, what he's going to call, political civic mechanisms. So one of the things that's also happening is you're getting secularized versions of what was initially these Christian ideas about the spread of white supremacy, the spread of imperial power. I'm noting this because I want us to look at the Declaration for a second. So the Declaration is a theological document, the Declaration of Independence. It is going to talk about having rights from God. They're all created equal, et cetera, et cetera. But wait a second. It's actually also a racist and white supremacist document. And let me explain what I mean. And let me give you two quotations from the Declaration. So one of the reasons, supposedly, that these colonies now have a justified reason to revolt against the king is that the king, quote, has excited domestic insurrections among us. What's this a reference to? Slave revolts. Slave revolts. You see, once African slaves are brought into what we're now thinking about the English colonial project in North America, not in the Caribbean, because of course England has colonies all over the Caribbean too. Once this is underway, there are all sorts of questions about, well, how are racialized white people going to be relating to racialized black people? And you have laws saying, for example, you can't teach black people, you can't teach African slaves to read. So in fact, even if they're freed, can't read. Nope, we're not going to baptize any African slaves because there is a fear that if we baptize them, now they're going to be free in every sense. Then you get laws that say, no, you know what? Okay, you can baptize them, but that doesn't grant them manumission. So it doesn't grant them political freedom. So notice there's this connection of whiteness to political power, to political ability, and the suppressing of what's seen as blackness. And of course, they're presented as barbarous, barren people that don't really know anything. They're savages. Aren't they so blessed to have us as their masters? And you're going to have people like Cotton Mather and at times Jonathan Edwards, et cetera. They're championing some of these ideas. So I'm noting this because laws during the colonial period are working to establish a racial hierarchy, modes of racial oppression, modes of racial exploitation, and especially after Bacon's Rebellion, where you had poor whites working with black slaves, and the landed gentry are like, oh no, we cannot have that because they greatly outnumber us. So you get this emphasis on, oh, you're white and they're black and they're bad. So you get a little bit of shine because you're white. You're not like them. They're at the bottom. Again, laws are working to maintain that. So one of the reasons you're going to get in the Declaration this mention of your exciting domestic insurrections is to continue to say, like, you're getting these black people riled up. Isn't that terrible? How dare you do that, King? But here's another one. Not only that, but remember I told you about the proclamation of 1763? Nope, you don't get to have all those lands. Washington, Jefferson, Franklin. Well, now they're upset. And listen to this in the Declaration. Quote, now we're talking about indigenous peoples. To bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So these poor white settlers are suffering under this barbarous, savage, lawless group, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what's so striking about this, by the way, is that when the founders are at their constitutional convention, guess what? They routinely draw upon Iroquois teachings about confederacies because they're like, wow, the indigenous have some amazing political structures. But do you see any of that here? No. Right? This is organized forgetting. You don't say anything about the greatness of the Iroquois, for example, and how you've been learning from them the ways in which you could have confederacies that would actually operate with some success. No, you just say that they're lawless, they're barbarous, they're barren, etc. Now let's say post-revolution, what do we have? And here's what I want to make sure you see. The founders intentionally establish a pigmentocracy, a government formed by white people. Let me give you a quotation from Thomas Jefferson to a minister of Britain asking, how are you going to relate to the indigenous peoples? Direct quotation. He says, we consider it as established by the usage of different nations into a kind of the law of nations for America. So he's talking about the doctrine of discovery. So it's like, yeah, no, we see this is established. Ready? That a white nation settling down and declaring that such and such are their limits makes an invasion of those by any other white nation an act of war. Now just pause. He's saying the United States is a white nation, just like all these European countries are white nations. You see, they're writing to each other. They're presuming, oh, yeah, you know that we made a pigmentocracy. You know that we're a white empire. You know that we're a white republic. You know that we're a white nation. But then he says, but gives no right of soil against the native possessors, which means the indigenous peoples, though they've been living here, because of the Doctrine of Discovery, they actually have no ultimate sovereignty and authority over their own lands. Nope. Mm-hmm. Now, here enters in something I want you to see. CRT scholar Kenneth Noon says the following. Law organizes white society. Then it helps maintain that society through both physical and ideological coercion. So law organizes white society. Then it helps maintain that society through both physical and ideological coercion. So if Jefferson and the founders are saying we're making a white nation, one of the things we should expect is that they're going to pass laws to protect and promote the white nation. And lo and behold, that's what we find. So brothers, hold on with me. I'm going to give us, we're moving towards 1955, but I want to take some step for those who just don't know some of this stuff. So think about the Constitution. Does it grant citizenship to any indigenous peoples? No. In fact, the only clause in the Constitution about indigenous peoples is how Congress will have the power to oversee commerce with indigenous peoples. Right. So indigenous peoples, no citizenship. Indigenous peoples do not get citizenship, U.S. citizenship, until 1924. They still don't have a guaranteed right to vote until 1957.
Wow.
Because between 24 and 57, the federal government allows states to determine if indigenous peoples get to vote. Look at the complete lack of power, political power. It's all intentional. Mm-hmm. Nope, you're not going to have any political power. But notice who else is not supposed to have any political power? Those that are racialized as black. So think about this. We get the three-fifths clause. We're going to get the fugitive slave clause. We're going to get the slave trade clause. It says, okay, yes, the slave trade, the transatlantic thing is going to die out. But don't worry, this is the thought, because we have all our own plantations and we're going to be making slaves. This is one of the reasons why now we've got to think what's known as intersectionally. Think about the connection between gender and race. Guess yes. What states like and colonies, but also states like Virginia do. They say slavery follows the maternal line, so the mother's line, not the paternal line. Why? So that you can make black women into slave factories.
Yes.
Yep.
So that the white slave master can have sexual relations with these people and just keep on having slaves.
Yes.
So that gets into that perpetual servitude. Now it's racialized and laws are protecting this.
Yes.
I want to give you something else though. The very first piece of immigration legislation that the United States Congress passes and that the president goes stamp, that's right, is what's known as the 1790s Naturalization Act, which declares that only white persons of good character living in the United States for 2 years can become citizens. Only white people.
Yeah.
Now, notice, this is something it doesn't explain. Who counts as white?
Yep.
And we have no explanation, but remember when Jefferson's writing to the British, like, oh yeah, we're a white nation, you're a white nation, and no white nation better come and step on us, or that's an act of war.
Right.
And notice how the indigenous are seen as non-white.
Right.
Same thing with the blacks. Oh, you're not white. So one of the key questions that's going to come up is, well, who's going to count as white and who's not? Mm-hmm. But remember, I've said many times, the U.S. is seen as a white empire. Historians of the U.S. largely, especially if the race goes, we agree, oh, of course it is. Mm-hmm. Because people like Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, as I told you, they had their eyes on lands out in the Ohio's and Illinois areas. And Illinois area. And they're like, oh, we're going to just keep on going. One of the reasons you're going to get the Louisiana Purchase. You're going to get the Monroe Doctrine. It's like, oh, yeah, all the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, let's get after that. Mm-hmm. Now, let me unpack how some of that works. All of these land grabs are going to get connected to the idea about the Doctrine of Discovery. So in 1823, there's a case that goes before the Supreme Court. Chief Justice John Marshall, who's a slaveholder, at the end of his life, I believe he has over 150 slaves, who maintains white supremacy. He has before him no indigenous peoples, but two racialized white people saying, well, one of us bought lands from the Indians, and one of us bought lands from a group that's connected to the government, so we want to know who actually owns the land. And Chief Justice John Marshall ends up saying, well, given the Doctrine of Discovery, which the United States endorses, indigenous peoples don't have land sovereignty. So you who bought the land from the indigenous, it doesn't really count. It's this person who bought it from the government. Now notice how that's working then. Well, if that's the case, if indigenous peoples don't really have any power over their lands, you can expect we're going to be seeing the U.S. go west, 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 west. Now, George Washington anticipates this. And in fact, 4 days after the treaty that ends the U.S. Revolutionary War is signed, George Washington starts sending, he sends a letter and says, this is what you need to do. Don't engage in warfare against the indigenous. That's going to be terrible. And Washington had been what's known as an Indian fighter for a long time. He said, don't do that. We'll set up a racial boundary. The non-white indigenous live over there. White people live over here. And then we're just going to keep encroaching over there. Because he had this idea. We're superior. They're inferior. They're going to die out. So why have all the bloodshed? Why have all the chaos? No, we're just going to, we'll get into treaties and we'll buy it. And then poof. Well, after Johnson versus McIntosh, you get what's known as the Removal Era. So in 1830, you get what's known as the Removal Act. It says all these indigenous groups in the South, out you go. You're going across the Mississippi. And here's a key question to ask. Why would we have these forms of genocidal migration passed by law? Here's one of the main reasons. The soil in places like Virginia is getting beat to death because of tobacco plantations. But there's going to be a chance to plant all sorts of things in what is clearly luxurious land, because these white settlers are looking at these indigenous people going, oh my goodness, look at all the stuff you're growing. This is amazing. So they want the land. And the United States, through things like the Three-Fifths Compromise, you see, it's actually set up to be what's known as plantocracy. It's a government for plantations. It's a slavetocracy. Mm. It's a government for slavery. Mm. And it's like, well, we need expansion because this is one of the main, not the only, but one of the main modes of our economy.
Yeah.
So indigenous people who don't have any land rights, out you're going to go. And one of the main people, of course, is behind this is President Andrew Johnson, is President Andrew Jackson, who, by the way, President Trump just loved so much. He had a portrait of him in the Oval Office. It's like, talk about being racist. Andrew Jackson's one of the most genocidal figures of white supremacists the world has ever seen. And Trump's mm-hmm. like, that's my boy. I'm going to be like him. It's like, oh my goodness. For those of us that know some history are like, no, this is bad.
Yeah.
So we're not surprised that Trump is trading in all the forms of racism he is. But I want to read you this powerful, powerful quotation that comes in a case called Worcester versus Georgia. So in Georgia, there are all sorts of questions about how Georgia does or does not as a state relate to the indigenous groups. And there's Cherokee Nation versus Georgia. That's 1831. Here comes another one, Worcester in 1832. Chief Justice John Marshall again. So those previous two, that's part of what's known as the Marshall Trilogy. This is the third. And this sets the bar for all subsequent Indian law. This is what Chief Justice Marshall says. I'm directly quoting. Power, war, conquest give rights. Power, war, conquest give rights. Which, after possession, are conceded by the world, and which can never be controverted by those on whom they descend. You'd think you were reading Foucault. Mm-hmm. Power, conquest, war determine rights. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons CRT scholars are talking about power dynamics is because the Supreme Court justices do. Mm-hmm. And of course they do, because what is a discussion about whose land can be dispossessed, who can be enslaved, if not a discussion of power and authority and of law?
Nathan, that's a good point. That's a great point.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation course. our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. I wonder if we don't pause here because we're getting right onto the cusp of the Civil War and maybe pick this up next time. But yep. here's the tragic irony is that you hear a lot of criticisms of CRT and of people who talk about systemic racism that you see everything in terms of power and you're just playing a race card. Right. Well, the issue is we created the race card. Like we invented it. We invented the power thing like you just named. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's fine as long as it's invisible and we're using it to our benefit. But as soon as the people who are being hurt by it mention it, then we cry foul, and then you want to see race and everything. And so like this historical development of the invention or creation of what it means to be white, seeing the world with a white gaze, if you will, and arranging other people's bodies and ethnicities on some sort of racialized hierarchy. Understanding the history of this helps, I think, answer, because one of the common pushbacks I hear when I talk about, hey, whiteness was invented, it was created for a purpose to justify and legitimize the taking of lands and the selling of bodies and basically the making of money. I mean, right? So it's serving mammon. Whiteness serves mammon.
Yep.
Well, the Bible mentions every tribe, tongue, and nation. The Bible sees all kinds of ethnicities. And so whiteness wasn't invented because the Bible talks about race. So maybe as a way of transitioning from the historical narrative to the end of our podcast and setting us up for next time, how do you answer that pushback or that rejoinder to this way of understanding American history?
Yeah, so let me read you a quotation from Nell Irving Painter's book, The History of White People. History of White People. This is chapter one. Were there, quote, white, end quote, people in antiquity? Certainly some assume so, as though categories we use today could be read backwards over the millennia. People with light skin certainly existed well before our own times. But did anyone think they were, quote, white, close quote, or that their character related to their color? This is the question she's asking. Her answer, no. For neither the idea of race nor the idea of white people had been invented, and people's skin color did not carry useful meaning. This is the consensus view of race scholars. Whiteness is a legal, political, and social construction that's bound up with European colonialism and imperialism. It doesn't exist before that. That's why I went back to Azuwater in 1444. And this is why, remember, that the whole we're a white nation, says Thomas Jefferson, the Naturalization Act of 1790, only white people. Well, here comes the key question. If whiteness is a legal, political, social construct, you're going to have to ask, well, who counts as white? And you're going to get a range of crazy answers because it doesn't track any biological permanent thing. So I tell my students this, there is no equivalent for race to something like the atomic number in the periodic table. There's no genetic set of nucleotides that makes it so you're white, so you're black, so you're Latino, Latina, so that you're Asian, et cetera, et cetera. No. These are social, legal, and political constructions. Remember, Indian is a legal category that gets constructed. So rather than paying attention to all these different tribes, all these different groups, like y'all are Indians, rather than paying attention to all these different racialized black communities, all y'all are black. Rather than paying attention to all these different Latino-Latina communities, all y'all Latinos and Latinas. All these different Asian communities, all y'all are just Asian. So I'm saying this because one of the most unfortunate things that's happened is people have not paid attention to the unique history of the construction of race and the practices of racialization and how those get suffused into the world. And so they project back onto the biblical text categories that don't exist.
That's right.
It's a tremendous problem. And I'll say this. If you read, I'll give you two scholars that are theologians that support what I'm saying. Willie James Jennings talks about this in The Christian Imagination. Mm-hmm. J. Cameron Carter and Race, a Theological Account, same thing. Yeah. Now, I think for most of your audience, you're probably going to find Jennings more accessible than Carter. Yeah. Carter's writing, frankly, for folks like me, you're just ready to wade through a whole lot of dense detail.
Yeah.
But both of them are like, oh, no, of course, race is not a biblical category. Yeah. But here's what I want to say. I'll conclude this because I know we're coming towards a point where we have to end. If you get a chance, go to Bible Gateway and look at various English translations of the Bible. But go back a ways and look at the King James Version and type in the word race. And guess what you're going to find? Every occurrence refers to the act of running. Something like run the race with endurance.
Yeah.
Why? Because the category race doesn't exist. But now you move into modern or contemporary translations. And guess what you start to find? Words like genos and ethnos translated as race.
Brother Nathan.
Oh, brother. Yeah. I've been on the grind on this stuff, and it's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a huge problem. And so when you get to Peter, right? And Peter's like, you're a royal priesthood, a holy nation, you're a new race. People are like, you see, the Bible talks about race. And I said, whoa.
Yeah.
Genos doesn't mean race like what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. But this gets constructed these ways. And then people go to Galatians 3 and they're like, oh, neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. I'm like, well, first off, slow your roll. Because I know most of you are really caring about what Paul has to say, for example, in Ephesians. And you think, well, here we got some real gender distinctions now, don't we? Mm-hmm. And we even have some distinctions between certain role responsibilities for those that are seen as masters and those that are going to be seen as slaves, etc. But one of the things I want to say is Paul's not talking about white supremacy. He's not talking about racism and forms of racism because they don't exist yet, which means, and this is very important, all those claims that Peter's sin is the sin of racism that you're going to hear in sermon after sermon, they're exegetically false.
Yeah.
Peter's not a racist. Now, does he have problems with othering practices? Sure. But people have othered folks pretty much since the fall.
Yes.
But they didn't other in terms of race because the conceptual resources necessary to see people as race didn't exist.
Yes. Yes. This is, Nathan, this is so helpful. I think there may be people listening who are hearing maybe for the first time, or actually it's pieces are falling into place like that old Plinko game from Price is Right, that whiteness and being white doesn't have an existence outside of a cultural, political, social creation.
Correct.
And so this world I live in that's obvious to me isn't reality. It's a construct or a lens that I'm using that I don't have to use.
Yeah.
And so next time I want to get into, we're going to continue the history, right? Because we're not done. And then we're going to talk about why CRT helps us see the whiteness lens. Yeah. And helps us understand why, for instance, the argument, well, if race is just a construct, let's just be colorblind. And that should take care of all the problems we have. Right. Mm-hmm. Or it helps us understand why the accusation of reverse racism isn't helpful. And what that obscures and misses. So we'll get into that stuff next time. Ben, you want to take us out? You have a thought or comment or closing quip? Or you want to pull a book off your shelf and regale us?
I was actually looking at the Christian Imagination while you were talking there because it reminded me of something that I'd read in there. But I think I'll end with this. I think this is something I noticed that you did, Nathan, throughout our conversation. And it sounds like a habit of language that you've cultivated, where you've talked about being racialized.
Yes.
Like you use that word, like racialized categories rather than race categories. Right.
Yep.
And I think, I'd love to hear your explanation for why you do that. But what I noticed it did for me was it further opened me up to this idea that I'm not inherently white. That's not an inherent or biological or something that's essential to me.
Right.
It's a story that has been told about me that is present in our culture, right? There's a story that's been told about you. And I think your story is so interesting and unique because there was all these, you got told various stories, right? And you were like, what, who the heck am I?
That's right.
You know, like I'm a black, or I'm not supposed to be black. I don't, you know, like, well, that's weird. And so I think it's unique. So anyway, so I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but I noticed that in the way that you were speaking. And I'm always looking for things like that, like little ways that I can change the way I talk that help sort of open people's minds up to the world that I'm trying to like give them or invite them into, rather than just telling them, hey, there's a different world, you should come into it. Like saying racialized seems to be a way to invite people into a different conception of thinking about that. So I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Yeah, so I'll say several things about this. So if race is not biologically essential, it's not biologically real in that sense. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that it isn't real in other senses. It's a political category, it's a social category, it's a legal category. So then we ask these questions. Okay, well, if we haven't always seen people as raced, when did we start racializing them?
Yes.
When do we undergo the process of seeing people's places, languages, hair textures, nose sizes, lip sizes, ideas about the size of somebody's genitalia? When did we start racializing those? When did we start seeing those as race? So remember what I talked about before, certain ideas about who's a threat or not, racialized. Certain ideas about sexuality and promiscuity, racialized. So it's not just about skin color.
Right.
So what I'm talking about then is the practice of racialization. So I'm thinking about these things in terms of verbs. So we racialize ourselves. We see ourselves as white, black, brown, red, yellow, et cetera, et cetera. And we're racialized by others.
Yes.
And that part's key because some people might say, like, I don't see myself as black. I don't see myself as Latino or Latina. It's like, well, the police might. The teacher might.
Right. Yeah, that might not matter.
I wasn't thinking about myself as a certain kind of Latino when I'm in the sixth grade in my English honors class, but my teacher sure was.
Yeah.
And she had sharp distinctions between nasty Puerto Ricans and, these poor beleaguered Cubans.
Interesting.
So we had all sorts of distinctions. She saw Cubans as closer to whiteness. I can talk more about that much later on. Mm-hmm. But there's a long history about that.
Yeah.
But so I'm talking about the ways in which we racialize ourselves, the ways in which others racialize us, and we racialize lands, languages, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the most helpful things you can do with it is say, how am I racializing myself and why? How do I see myself as race? And then here's another question. How are other people racializing me and why?
Yes.
And why? And we have to understand that these are social categories. It's going to lead to social practices so that, for example, my very first chapel that I gave a homily for at Wheaton College, it was the very first, what's known as the Unidad group, so it's the Latino-Latina group on campus, the very first chapel that we did. It ends up that during the worship service, a student takes a picture of us, makes a racist meme, and uses certain distinctively Latino racist tropes against us. Right? Hey, it doesn't matter in that moment how I'm seeing myself. This is how this person sees me. This is how this person takes my body, takes a photo of it, takes a photo of me worshiping, and other Latinos and Latinas worshiping, and then makes a racist meme out. Like, this is how these things operate. So then I want to say one more thing, because this is very important. You will consistently hear me, too, say the racialized majority and the racialized minority. Why? Because majority and minority are relative concepts. When I'm down in Boricua, in Puerto Rico, I'm part of the racialized majority in terms of the island. Why? Because I'm Puerto Rican. I'm from Puerto Rico. But when I go to South Carolina to visit family, I'm a racialized minority. Why? I'm not part of the racialized majority. That would be the Anglos. Or those we're going to see as racialized white in the United States. But I'm going to make those important distinctions because there are various forms of whiteness that go on. You get the Iberian conceptions versus the British conceptions versus the U.S. ones. So when we're in different zones, we can be part of the majority or the minority. And so sometimes it's, in fact, wild when you hear those that are racialized in the United States as white. They're deemed white, seen as white, treated as white. They go to a place like Kenya, and they're like, wow, look at all these racialized minorities. And you're like, no, sister, brother, like... You're the racialized minority in terms of this country, and they're the majority.
But
they don't see that because of the racialization practices and patterns that they're socialized into in the United States.
We gotta talk
and
about
how
this
we've been taught that that's universal.
Anyway,
we gotta talk about
how
some more.
How power plays into this too, right?
Because
I rode bikes in college. I did bike races, and you pace line when you're doing a road bike. So the person in front is sort of, they take the wind for you and you kind of ride in their slipstream. But if you're riding by yourself, you don't notice the wind when it's at your back.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. You only notice it when you're riding into it. And I feel like power is the same way. When power is at your back, you don't see it. You don't notice it. You don't understand how you benefit from it.
You just think you're a great athlete.
You just think, man, I'm 27 miles an hour right now. I am crushing it. And then you turn around to come home and you're at 16 miles an hour and you feel like you want to die.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
May I give one example that illuminates what you said? I know we got to be careful for time. So yeah, if
go
you
for
wait,
it. Go for it. I'm having a great time.
So there was it's one day. I'm in New Jersey. I'm with fellow Latinos, just males. So that's why I'm using Latinos. I'm not trying to cover male and female here. But we go into what's known as a quickie shop. So it's kind of like a 7-Eleven. I don't know what your particular gas station stores are called wherever you live. But this one was called a quickie shop. And so we walk in, and immediately the store owner starts berating us and ends up chasing us out of the store and says, I know your people always steal. You're only here to take my stuff. Get out. Now, I'm devastated. I'm like, I can't even go into a store and buy something without all these suspicions, expectations. And I know the people that I was with. None of us were shoplifting. Mm-hmm. But I go home, and one of our family practices was to have a dinner conversation, and we would talk about what happened that day. And so I'm sharing with my family. And I gotta be honest now, these conversations were tense because there wasn't robust race consciousness growing up in my family. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of ways in which my dad was playing up and playing down being Puerto Rican. And my mom was like, I'm white. None of my kids are white like I'm white. I don't get what's going on. And what about my white family? And all sorts of things like that were happening. Mm-hmm. So we're at the dinner table and I go, it was a crappy day. And my mom says, why was it a crappy day? So I got chased out of a store by this racist store clerk who told me and these other Latinos that we can't be in there because he knows that our people are going to steal. My mom gets irate. And my mom's like, what store was this? So I tell her it was the quickie shop on Eastern Avenue. And she says, wait, what? I said, yeah, no, it's the quickie shop on Eastern Avenue. Hold on, I might have to get tissue, y'all. Hold on. So she's like, it couldn't be. I said, yeah, that was the one, Mom. And she said, I was in there earlier today and they treated me so well. Mm. I looked at her and I said, yeah, because you're not a Latino threat, Mom. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of conversations that happen in these multiracialized families. And it's painful stuff. Like I had no hate for my mom. I'm not like, well, because you're a white woman, everybody.
No.
The point is like, how are you going to enter into the sufferings of your children? We're getting chased out of the store that the same day you're in, and you're getting red carpet treatment. Yes. Because they're seeing you as a white woman that's probably middle, upper middle class. I'm like, whoa, we're going to make some sales today. And they see me as a threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's striking to me, Nathan, that, I mean, the word prophet occurred in the papal bull in the 15th century.
Yeah.
And your telling of this story in what, the 1990s, early 2000s, is still about profit. It's still about money and how it's all tied up. And man, we have to pause here. We're going to come back next time. We're going to maybe pick up the story with Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
The worst person ever to appear on a $20 bill. And we'll go forward through contemporary time. And then getting this picture, we're going to then, I think, drill down granularly onto how CRT and the tools that are used in that, how they help us see things we can't see otherwise, and name the things that need to be named so we can free ourselves from the hegemony of racialization. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Sounds good, brothers. Man, it's been a joy to talk with you.
Brother, this has been wonderful. Thanks for your time, and we'll chat again soon. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the start recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.